We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
How about I go ahead and address the larger than average elephant in the room?
No, I have never coached the sport that you folks call football. And heck, you could fill two internets with what I don't know about football.
Hold on, man. If I were to get fired from my job where I'm putting cleats in the trunk of my car.
You got the boot for putting boots in the boot.
I love that. You know what the happiest animal on earth is? It's a goldfish. You know why?
No.
It's got a 10-second memory. Be a goldfish, Sam.
All right, welcome back to Big Screen Sports, the sports movie podcast brought to you by Blue Wire Podcast. I am your host, Kyle Bandujo. It is our season two Ted Lasso rewatch finale episode. We have somehow made it 12 episodes already with this, frankly, fucking perfect show. Joining me, as always, it is my co-host from For the Win, where you can find all the content. It is Alex McDaniel. Alex, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great. Swimming in content. Doing great.
All the content. You know who else has a lot of content? Our good friend Caroline Darney over Bet for the Win, who is returning to Big Screen Sports tonight. Caroline, how are you?
I'm doing great. And yeah, so much content over at Bet for the Win. So if you don't get your fill at For the Win, you can slide on over to Bet for the Win. Get a little dessert, little pretzel, if you will. I don't know why I went pretzel for dessert, but honestly, I was in Germany for 2 weeks, so it kind of was all...
And I was at an airport last night, so I saw an Auntie Anne. So same thing, really.
Yeah, that's about, yeah, pretzels
and
for any meal.
And the theme of returning friends, returning guests, we had to get a guy who knows a little something about tapping a sign for inspiration. It is our friend Mike Golic Jr. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Shout out to all my friends at Oklahoma that are for some reason pissed off with renewed energy about said sign. And shout out to Bradley International in Connecticut that is getting an Auntie Anne's pretzel very soon, and I am jazzed about it.
I mean, an Auntie Anne's is a fine meal in any circumstance, but especially during a layover. This is now an Auntie Anne's podcast. Auntie Anne's,
welcome.
They put a hot dog inside of a twisty pretzel.
Mike's gonna buy plane tickets like real cheap. Just no, like not go anywhere. Just go to the airport in Connecticut, get some Auntie Anne's.
I'm back for lunch, fam. What's up?
Get a job just to get through security and back.
The official next sponsor of AFC Richmond, Auntie Anne's. Mike, where can the listeners check you out on TV this weekend?
I am going to be Friday night on ESPN1 for Clemson going on the road to Syracuse to take on the Orange in the Dome. So looking forward to that one. Me and Anish Shroff and Taylor McDaniel. Going to be a good time.
You know who's probably not looking forward to that one? Clemson fans. Can't imagine that they're super excited about that.
Why? Nothing's ever gone really, really horribly wrong against Syracuse for Clemson, ever.
There's something special about seeing fan bases that really aren't used to, like, that have had this stretch of success that hit this stretch where it's, like, still what most teams would probably be okay with having as their season. And then I went on deployment with a guy who went to Oklahoma, and I remember it was like game three or something, and they lost to like a back end of the top 25 team. And he's like, well, that's the season. They're not going to make like championship game. I'm not going to watch anymore. And I was sitting there like FaceTime or like, you know, Skyping my parents to turn the TV to watch Duke, Virginia. And I was like, what do you mean you're not going to watch anymore? Like, 'cause they lost a game. Like, what are we doing here?
It's like in the U 30 for 30 when the players talk about like they gave away like bowl rings and stuff, like anything that wasn't a national championship was just like, fuck it. And you're just like, come on, man. Come on.
That's all we want is a bowl game, guys.
Break me off a piece of that Orange Bowl, please, sir. All right. Well, something else to shout out. The Patreon of this podcast. Shout out to our newest patron, Chris Mykoski, a great sports broadcaster. He's a producer level patron, along with Aaron Figueroa, Mike Schubert, Steve Rogers, Kevin Frost, Mike D, Ryan Yeager, Mike Dreese, and James Kowalewski. Go to patreon.com/bigscreensports. You can support the show. Vote on movies that this podcast is going to cover. We got the poll for the November movie up right now. A couple bangers in that one. Go to patreon.com/bigscreensports and pick us out a winner. But for tonight, we are talking about Ted Lasso Season 2, Episode 12, Inverting the Pyramid of Success. Richmond gets their final chance to win promotion as Ted deals with the fallout of Trent Crim's painfully honest expose. I mean, folks, this was an okay episode. We can probably wrap this in like a tight 20, right?
It was fine. That's my summary. It was fine.
Had its moments.
Yeah. Take it away.
Caroline, I'll kick it to you first. Oh, you got to go first. You were last on the Zoom. So
how it goes.
By default. Okay. By default, it's not like you were furthering your education or helping save your dog. So no.
Last in, first out. I learned that in business school, LIFO method of,
Exactly. So, you wrap this one, and when you wrap this one, the last thing you see is a fully gray Nate. Your reaction when you let this episode wash over you, what was that instant first reaction?
How can I punch him in the face? Might be. There's so much emotion. And I know, like, we'll get to like the funny parts. I think that this was a funny episode. It wasn't one of the ha 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 ha, like, but it had a constant level of just the feels. And it was, I guess it's every Ted Lasso episode. So I always have a podcast to talk about all these things, but it was the highs and lows of this might have been the most actual soccer that has been shown in an episode or close to it. It felt like that. And I loved the amount that we got. It was perfect and it was necessary. But closing on Nate and the gray, I mean, they looked like they were ready to train the bad guys in a Mighty Ducks movie. You know, like I got those types of vibes. Like this is the team that in the big green, like shows up with all their uniforms and sync and, you know, AFC Richmond will show up missing some pieces of equipment that they need or whatever it is. But seeing that, I don't know if I noticed throughout the course of the second season that Nate was getting grayer. And then at that moment, you're like, oh, wow, he's super gray. Was that like a thing that was happening? And it just was a great visual representation of a simmering but noticeable transition that coursed through the entire vein of the season that just was, I thought it was, I mean, everything they do is perfect and has a point and comes into play and was a really nice bookend because they really kind of open season one or season two with that same type of like close up on Nate's face. That again, the bookends and the symmetry and the, I just loved it. And also catch these hands, like, yeah,
catch these hands. It was a full Darth Vader moment, really.
Yeah.
Mike, when you wrap this one, when you think about like what your hopes, your expectations, your dreams for the season two finale, where did this land for you?
I thought it was great in a lot of ways. Number one, talking about that end credit scene, no one has ever gone wrong using Run the Jewels to either bring in or take out a season right there. Yankee and the Brave to finish it off. Just, they have a good way of like punctuating notes, but no, this is everything I've come to expect with this show, which is making me laugh hysterically by myself through the fresh tears on my face. Yes. Like that was the entire cadence of this episode. Like it yo-yos between emotions in a way that only a show that invested this much time on the front end of this season, a season that was much maligned by a lot of people who watched, I think just dealt with watching in a different way this time around than a lot of us did for season one. Like it ultimately got us into a place where they could really just tug at our emotions in a way that is only possible with that kind of groundwork. So I thought they nailed it. And I think we're set up for what is going to be a very nice capstone on this in season three.
Alex, as the official queen of Ted Lasso theories, someone who has proven right many a time, multiple times this season, especially by this finale, was it just satisfaction at its highest when this wrapped?
I mean, I don't know if it was satisfaction. I think it's weird for a few reasons. Well, you know, I was really upset about Trent Krim for obvious reasons, all the journalism stuff that I bring up. And so, like, to see him acknowledge that he did the absolute thing you cannot do as a journalist, and so he had to walk away from it, I was happy with that. The Nate thing I thought was going to happen, but it happened in a way I did not expect. And you notice, like, the last shot of the show, which parallels the first shot of the season, except his eyes are, like, completely black the way that they shot it. Whereas in the first season, there's hope, you know, and, like, he's not totally gone yet. And I just think the way they ended it was beautiful and disturbing, but that was kind of the whole point. The season was set up to make us uncomfortable because talking about mental health should make us uncomfortable. And this whole thing is about vulnerability and people reaching their highest potential. And I think this season did not hesitate in getting into that really quickly. So I know I'm breaking the rule and talking about the whole season. I'm sorry.
No, there are no rules. He's either Nate is either Darth Nate or Voldenate. I'll take either or any suggestions, but it is, you know, I want to talk about Trent Krim, something that was very late in my notes, but as people in journalism and just talking about Nate, if Trent Krim, you know, Trent Krim was fired by the Independent, I would assume that every reporter in that last press conference would find out why, would know why. It would become a common thing of what went down with that article about Ted and how that happened and who the source was, why Trent left the Independent. Would you imagine that the greater journalism population covering AFC Richmond, covering Premier League, now covering West Ham, know that Nate rolled on Ted in that way? Alex, I'm going to kick it right back to you. What do you think? As you are the Trent Krim, the leader in the Trent Krim clubhouse right now.
I don't know if they would have thought it was Nate, just because Trent is clearly painted as the one who's closest to the team. If there is a Richmond beat writer, like, dedicated, it's Trent, right? So I don't know if they would have known that Nate was the one, because a lot of those journalists are kind of, some of them are tabloids, and we've talked about journalism standards being different in the UK. So I don't know, but I did think that was so chilling kind of in the press conference when he says Trent's name and he's not there and nobody really reacts to it. And so, I mean, I don't know, as a journalist, like, I found some satisfaction in it, but I think the show intentionally painted Trent as somebody who just stands out above everybody else, as somebody who's going to try to get the real story. And that's why he has the relationship he does with Ted.
I just wanted to jump in, because what you pointed out about that press conference, I am not, like, an actual journalist. Like, I always have to point that out to the people who want to, like, rip me on Twitter. I was like, I'm an entertainer, folks. I didn't go to Big J school. So I'm just here to talk. I don't know the rules. That's, like, the cool part is I've gotten to, like, ask, like, you know, the Spencer Halls and the Nicole Arbuckle of the world and, like, bounce this off you guys. But that part right there is the most athlete thing that I saw for this season, because that feeling you just described is when a guy gets carted off and they blow the whistle for the next play. Like, that's that feeling where you realize, oh, that's right, this whole machine does not need me to survive. And you watch the whole thing continue to play out, or everyone else watches the whole thing and has to just keep going after this person is gone for whatever reason. And it's always, like, no matter the setting, a very haunting reminder. But just hearing you say that now, I didn't register that, because, again, like, that's not my background, but that is the feeling you 100% describe.
And they left the seat, which, if, you know, if you're on a beat and you're in the same spot every time, like, leaving the seat is kind of like, oh, this is Trent Krim, the Independent seat. Like, that's just, and I didn't realize until doing this, like, bigger rewatch that I did over the past few days, shout out to being able to on a plane and nowhere to go. but I didn't realize that Trent was kind of digging for this story before Nate, right? Like, he ran into him in the pub and was like, hey, like, little food poisoning, like, and he was like, yeah, not from here, like, not May's restaurant. Yeah. So he was like, he asked for the comment. So my biggest thing with, I agree with Alex, like, from listening to the podcast last week, you talk about, okay, you can't out your source. And if you're outing your source, you don't have a second source, you know, all these basic big J things. Like, if he's going to immediately out the source and get and know that he's ending his writing career over this, why write this story? Like, that was the big thing. That's the only thing that stuck for me. Cause I was like, he was digging into it, trying to figure out like that sort of stuff. Like, I get, like, but there wasn't enough. This was more of a tabloid story than a Trent Crim story.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely got some Trent Crim speculation coming. Go ahead, Mike.
Do you guys, and again, I apologize. I know we're like completely breaking order on this, but
we got no rules, baby. We're free and clear.
Flying.
To the point of why you do this, knowing you're going to leave, do you guys all believe, like, I'm getting way ahead to season three predictions, he writes the book?
That, yeah, that's kind of what I literally thought too. That's yeah. what he was going to ask yeah. Ted in that parking lot, was say, I'm working on something new.
Yeah.
And it's about you. So I guess they left the trail of breadcrumbs. But I want to, Mike mentioned the machine, you know, the media machine, the football machine, whatever. This show, and in a sense, for me, was like a machine. And Caroline mentioned it, you know, earlier about, you know, nothing, the show does everything deliberately. The whole thing, it was like, you know, I'm not mechanically inclined, but it was like gears, like everything fitting in perfectly, just spinning it. They placed every single little thing, filled every, like, grabbed every little breadcrumb, except one, which I'm going to get to later. There's one thing that they left out completely that I've got questions about, but everything else was perfect. When we had the aforementioned Spencer Hall on the season one finale, and he talked about how hard it is to land a finale, to stick the ending perfectly. And the show has now done it twice in two seasons in essentially less than the span of a year. Might be the most incredible thing about the show is that it has stuck these two finales as well as you could possibly hope to do, and not left any, they don't do it with any humongous cliffhangers. They don't do the Thrones thing or anything like that. It's just like, we've got some questions. We've got some stuff that we're really curious about, you know, for next season, but it's not like a who, you know, who shot JR. God, that I didn't watch Dallas,
how,
but that's
how
that's
old like, are you?
I was gonna say,
did guys, my mom write this?
I'm actually secretly 60 years old. You guys have thought I'm 30 the whole time.
This is your grandfather's podcast.
but
Dallas it's, theme stuck
it's
in my
nothing.
Head.
Yeah, it's nothing like that. Nothing like that. So let's roll into best scene of this one. And I would just like to let you all know, don't feel pressure to like pick one. I've wrote down pretty much everything. We are going to get to everything. Caroline, what was the best scene in this finale for you?
Oh gosh. I think what I really, really liked about this finale is there were a lot of bookends on things, and not just like, so, you know, you had the throwback to the premiere, the pilot episode with the big piece of cereal, right? You had that moment. You had obviously the, I think a lot of people, and thankfully you mentioned Nicole Auerbach earlier. She gave Alex and I a little bit of a heads up, like, hey, the first scene, like the start to season two is a little weird. Don't let it throw you off. And so like, as an obsessive dog owner, that was a tough start for me, but I trust the showrunners enough where I was like, okay. And that to me was probably, I know it's so cheesy and obvious to choose the like feel good sports moment of the sports show as my favorite scene, but I will tell you what, you haven't lived until you are crying on a bus in outside Munich on the way to lunch for like a school program visit, and you're watching it on your phone because you're so worried about spoilers. And I had to watch it in three chunks. It was like 30 minutes, 20 minutes, 10 minutes or whatever. It was like so ridiculous, but just the Jamie, just you saw so many of the player development or like character developments with Jamie going from this guy that literally will not pass the ball to anyone else to passing up the game tying penalty kick to like get up, like unrelegated. What am I thinking of the right word?
Called it.
Back up. I don't know. Promote it. There we go. Unrelegated is the official term, guys. You just don't know. It's
you did just get back from Europe. So we're
I'm an expert.
We trust
now.
You.
100%. To knowing that that's a moment that is such a big deal for Danny, like, and seeing little Macy Greyhound in the helmet was, again, the bookends, the full circle, like literally circle of life for Danny, because he's like, I killed this other one and here's the sweet, sweet puppy that will grow into our mascot. And the, like, again, so cheesy, but like, and the way that they used the juxtaposition between our favorite super fans and May in the bar, and how they're doing the same chants that are happening in the stands, and how the chants tied into everything that was like going on. So whether it was like Sam about to go have the conversation with Edward about whether or not he was staying, and he's leaving the locker room to, we're Richmond till we die. So like just that entire way that they presented that, managed to do it without feeling like tropey or cliche. And like they won, and it was this thing that you hoped and expected they'd get to, but it didn't feel like it was a given at any moment. You didn't quite know how they were going to get there. And I thought it was just really, really beautiful. I loved it.
And it's pretty incredible that they, like you said, we didn't have, this episode had as much soccer as we've really gotten. They didn't make the soccer. That's what's so cool about the show, is it's a sports show. It's about the soccer team, but it's not about the on field. This is about the on field. We care if they do well. They make us invest enough that we care if this team does well. And that's what's important, because when they show them on the field, we're invested enough in that we live and die with them on the field, even though we're not this, the show isn't about like each episode, there's a game and they got to win it. It captures that perfect part about sports. It captures the emotion more than just the on field. And it's perfect. Like Danny hitting that shot, man, Papa Tart like had to be super pissed watching that from like a London drunk tank. Just like when Jamie passes that ball, he had to go nuts. Mike, what was the best scene in this one for you?
Oh, I like, even just now I've had like six written down, and I've been going back and forth between all of them trying to figure out, because like I skew very heavily towards like a lot of the team moments on here, because I think that's like an element of my life that I miss a lot, is the moments that they have there. And I think they get a fair amount of this stuff right. But I think I got to go to the whole scene with Roy and Keeley in the kitchen, when Keeley tells him the news about what's going to happen with her getting her own PR firm, and then the Vanity Fair shoot comes in, because it is like all of the growth for Roy, like it's all the things we love. So when they're looking at the magazine and Keeley is apologizing that Roy is not in there, and he goes, you look fucking powerful, and all of these great things, like that is Roy, who continues to be like a champion for healthy relationships and the way that we should view people, and like how to do this all in a way that is natural and supportive to him. But my favorite moment for him so far, and it manifests in what could be the second best scene in the reunion of the Diamond Dogs later on, is when Roy finally cracks, because Roy is a pillar. Roy is strength. Roy is like this towering testament of what I can build my life into through sport based on where I came from. And when Keeley tells him about his news, and he breaks for just a second and says, you're not going to have any more time for me. And that was like, whoa, like this guy finally is getting to the spot where we remember going back to the season one finale. And I remember Spencer talking about with you guys, the pitch in the locker room were home for Roy at a time where he really needed it. And then Keeley came in and became that home when it left, and he can feel that slipping away, and it's scaring the shit out of him. And that was like the smallest concession of that, because that's how Roy works. Like there aren't wild emotive swings. There are small concessions. And that was, to me, like just kind of like, it was like an earthquake on that scene. So that one stuck out.
And they still make it funny when he says, you hurt my feeling. Singular.
I know, my one feeling. You heard it.
You hurt my feeling. Like, and I realized that it hurt my feeling. And I was like, stop making me laugh. I'm about to cry for one.
I also have to ask you guys a question, because at the end of the scene in the kitchen, he says, you look like a BILF. Is that a boss I'd like to, like, is that what that's supposed
that's
to be?
What I, back that's what I
think so.
Yeah. That was
that's
my
what
assumption.
I got. That's yes. what I got out of it. Yeah.
Yes.
You hurt my feeling.
I mean, while we're on the Roy Keeley thing, probably, you know, as big a thing that happened in this episode, Alex, I mean, you were lead on this theory. You were the lead investigator in Scotland Yard or whatever it is over there. And so because it's really two interesting scenes. It's the, you know, it's when he tells her the scene that Mike's referring to in the kitchen, and you know, Keeley has that the moment she says, you know, I love you so much. It's not as though she's anticipating that this is slipping away or anything like that. She's not. She doesn't seem to be worried. And then we have, you know, the parallel of the plane ticket scene, which again doesn't seem like, you know, it doesn't seem like a breakup or anything of that sort, but it does seem like, you know, something weighty has happened.
So let me.
Yeah.
You didn't even know you didn't know my favorite scene, but I was going to say I thought that was the best scene. Good. Like, we have instincts now. This is great. We're doing great. So I want to start by saying, like, when you're, and I swear I won't go on a tangent. It's relevant. When you're a woman growing up and you're ambitious, you may not be told this directly, but it's very clear from observing your mother, your grandmother, women who have a career in a family, it's very apparent to you that you were told you're going to have to pick. You don't get it all. So you either get to be really good at your career and kind of shitty as a mom and a wife, or you can be a great wife and a mom. Like, you are conditioned to believe you're going to have to pick, and men do not have to go through that. And so the reason I loved the airplane ticket scene so much, we're seeing two things. We're seeing Roy, who's still like, he's got insecurities and he's trying to get over them. And to him, because he's never really been in a relationship like this, he sees her choice as pulling away. And are we going to break up? I see it as she's choosing herself and she's choosing him at the same time. And she's saying, I'm going to have all of the things I want. Maybe not the way you want them to go down. Like, of course he doesn't want her to. They don't want to be apart for 6 weeks. I get it. But she's saying, like, I'm not going to sacrifice one for the other. I'm not going to quit the job and I'm not going to quit you. And, you know, I'm not a cynic. LOL. Of course I am. I just think I don't know. Over the years, I just think if you find a love, and I don't just mean romantic love, I mean friendships and family, that's built to withstand a tricky career or long distance or something. Yes, you want to hold on to it if it works, but you also don't want to sacrifice yourself to keep it. And so to me, as a feminist and as somebody who's constantly juggling like my son and my job, I just think it's so empowering without her having to go on this big rant about it by saying, I want both. I want you and I want the job and I have to give the job focus right now. But if this love is strong enough, it'll be there when I'm back.
This was the first time I was really disappointed in their communication, because usually I think that they do really well with that. And that's something that they've shown really well. Look, I would love to spend 6 weeks with Roy Kent. Anywhere, literally anywhere. Pick a spot. But also, told me that you had already picked 6 weeks and presented me with the tickets, I would feel so stressed in that moment. And I don't know if that's just a me thing or if that's like, but I know people have different love languages, and I am a gift giver. I like to get things. I like to make people happy. Like, but that to me, like, I wanted her to be like, I cannot do 6 weeks. Let's do two. You know what I mean? Like, I just wanted something in there. Like, just because, God, 6 weeks, that's a lot just to drop on someone's lap.
Oh, yeah. No, it's completely insane. That is the act of a that's the act of a desperate man, though. Like, yes. That is a guy who does not know how to do what he's doing. And that's like the theme for Roy from here on out, is post football, he is trying to figure all this shit out. And all he knows are, I feel strong and safe with this thing, and I feel like I'm losing it. So he swung big. Cause 2 weeks, that's an appropriate vacation length. Yes. 6 weeks is an insane time commitment for anybody. I so love Roy, but that was nuts.
That's how do I pack escapade. For that?
That's a life.
No, I was just going to say, like, even if you had the time to spare, let's say you didn't have a job. My mind instantly goes to like, how am I going to, okay, I got to pay my bills. Let me put them on auto pay. Let me make sure I clean my fridge out. There's too much to just uproot your life for 6 weeks. But I agree with Mike. Like, he's kind of like a child in that way. Just like he was reading the Da Vinci Code back in that episode when they were fighting.
Like, hey, that's a good book.
It is a good book. But
he talks about the studded belt. Like,
I know.
This guy is a studded belt.
Can you believe this? Like, and the Da Vinci Code. And he's just discovering things that he hasn't had. And it's like he told her, he's like, I haven't had a proper vacation since I was 12. And we know his whole life has been about football. So yeah, he is learning. And I think it's easy when you're an insecure person, or you have certain insecurities, I should say, to feel like if somebody you love doesn't go along with something you planned, oh, it's rejection. Even if they say they love you, even if they say, no, 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 it was a great idea, I just can't do it. When you're just getting started with that stuff, everything is either acceptance or rejection, right? So.
But Kathy should be able to help him out with this. I love that he has a travel agent.
With the printed tickets.
With the printed tickets.
He's just like my dad, by the way. So like ESPN, when you book travel, there's an app called Concur that you can do online. Yeah. It's like super easy to use. My dad, who was here for 20 years, even when Concur was implemented, refused. He talked to the same woman in Disney Global Travel every time he booked his stuff and did it all by phone and absolutely refused to compromise.
That makes me so happy.
I need Roy Kent calling a game with Mike Golic. A game of like not football or soccer, just like a game of anything. I would also, for a season 3 one-off episode, it's just Roy Kent watching the Da Vinci Code movie and just being incredulous at some changes. But
nice so, of Templar.
A few weeks ago, when Alex texted me her theory that Roy and Keeley would end the season on a break and ruin my afternoon, I imagined a scene, something like with a lot of tears and someone saying, I just can't do this right now, and it feeling like a split, like I don't know what's going to happen next season. This feels stronger, and it feels like Keeley's putting trust in this relationship and their bond to, you know, make it through this 6 weeks. And it's going to be a 6 weeks of discovery for both of them being apart. I was in a long distance relationship for a year and a half. Being apart is a big, big deal. And I also can't imagine that Roy is like a very like a have to like a text constantly guy. Maybe he is because of how attached he is to Keeley. I don't know, but it's something that I feel, and Caroline, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like I still feel very strong about them. I feel like this is a couple that's healthy enough that can get through this, and this quote-unquote break could actually be a good thing.
I don't know. I felt really nervous. When I rewatched the episode, I just, like, got really, like, anxious again watching that scene, just because I do love them with my entire heart. And it's brilliant by the writers. It's something that adds a little bit of tension, because everything that you said is correct. Like, they have a strong relationship. They've communicated well. There's no reason that they should not, you know, but that's what they did in the last episode before, was sow the seeds with whether it was Jamie's declaration of love, even though that was resolved. And we know, like, I feel confident being like, Keeley's not just going to go run off and cheat with Jamie. Like, I'm 100% confident in that. In the same with the way that Roy interacted with the teacher and has over the entire course of the show had a good rapport with her, whether it's her telling him he can't swear at the small children that he's coaching and all that good stuff. But I agree. I think that they have that relationship. It's just part of me is just like, but I need them I need this to work.
But it can. Really to work. I just don't feel like it's the end. I think, and I realize I'm just kind of being unusually optimistic here, but I think when you find something and it works, regardless of what you call it and regardless of what you label it, if it works and it's, I don't want to say meant to be, because I don't believe everything is left up to fate in the universe. You have choices to make, and choices are a big theme of this episode. I just think if it works, it can withstand 6 weeks of him being gone.
This is when we turn it into a Loki episode.
I think Roy needs 6 weeks to be gone. He said it to Keeley himself. He's never gone on a holiday that doesn't involve him rehabbing his knee or something like that. And he's also never really been alone, but alone in a way of like relaxation and enjoyment. I'm sure he spent a bunch of nights alone in an apartment, like, you know, with the pressure of being Roy Kent, but like, go on the beach and drink some fucking Mai Tais, man, and just like relax, like be yourself. Like, there, Dan Brown's written a bunch of books. Like, crack some of those. Like, you've got all this free time. Like, watch Squid Game. Like, you just
learn
do
to be alone.
You. Exactly. Yeah, and that will do so much for Roy and Keeley after the fact. I think, Mike, you got something?
Well, no, I just, to Alex's point, like, that's the whole thing with Roy's. He doesn't know how to be alone at all. And that's why, because like, I've had this conversation with a bunch of people who think, yes, their relationship is healthy enough to converse through this. But I think the whole idea is those little fissures that Caroline talked about, like, it's a reminder, like, this just may not like work for them. Like what Roy needs, he's figuring out right now. What Keely needs, I think she's got a little bit firmer hand on. That's kind of like what this whole thing has been, is she's a little more comfortable in this situation. And I think with a lot of the things I think are going to come for Roy in season three, it's, this has all been very instructive for him. It might not be what he needs in this spot. And the beautiful part is, even if it doesn't work, it won't be like because it's either of their faults. Like yeah. There won't be a bad guy here. There won't be someone who's at fault. It will be two people who understand maybe our needs just don't align at the same time. And that's okay.
I just want to say Bill Lawrence will be the bad guy if they don't end.
Yes. My heart will still explode.
I will personally consider him the bad guy. Folks, let's take a quick ad break so I can figure out what my best scene is going to be.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Okay, we're back, and I took that very, very long ad break to decide what my best scene of the episode is. And I am going to go with the team meeting between Ted and AFC Richmond out on the pitch when he talks about the article. It says, you should have found out about it from me first. Ted takes this moment. This struggle for it has not been an easy day for Ted, and he's dealing with it on a lot of ends there. He's got Beard ready to like rip Nate's spine out of his body. He's got paparazzi outside of his apartment. He's got everyone in the street asking him if he's okay, stuff like that. And it's Ted taking this moment to build more trust with his team. The team comes out stronger out of this and them having this conversation. There are certain professional coaches who have been in the news recently could probably take some lessons from Ted Lasso on how to build trust with your team and how to do the right thing. It might not have been the most impactful moment of this season or the thing that furthered the plot the most, but it was just, for me, it was something that it's like so instrumental in what makes the show good. It was a guy who was in a tough situation talking about something that's difficult for anyone to talk about and taking his opportunity to, and fulfill what his mission is getting close to his players and lifting these guys up and helping out. And every single one of these guys knows that Ted is someone that they can go to. And I think it was really important to watch. And you also get Beard saying horticulture, baby. And that's that's also
horticulture, baby.
God, someone on YouTube needs to make a super cut of all those. I'm sure someone with some video editing skills. Alex, go ahead.
First of all, I think I do like one college football tweet a week where I'm like Coach Beard voice something baby, because I think it's great. We haven't seen too many moments of Ted getting close to his team this season. I think we've talked about that a lot. Like, obviously we know why, we know he was going through stuff, but you didn't see a lot of Ted centric scenes with them. And so this was the first one that reminded me of like Ted from season one, like the believe guy and, want to get to know them, want them to love us. Cause if they love us, it's going to be great. And we can get into a whole thing about pyramid of success. But I loved that scene because he admits to them, like, I should have told you, and I hate it. And his team immediately responds with just being furious with whoever leaked the story.
What was it? It was bars of soap and socks.
Yeah, and then
Colin.
Colin's so weird.
Colin was watching said, prison.
Someone said, recently. "Follow the money."
That's what
follow,
I was gonna
the
say.
Money.
Follow the money.
Follow the money.
And so I agree. I thought, even though it was a scene, of course, we see Nate being uncomfortable because he's afraid he's going to get beaten up. But it was one of the first times, like all season, that we've seen him really have a breakdown moment with the team. And I loved it.
I will say, to that end, you mentioned two things. One, the team responded immediately. And I don't have this off the top of my head, but anecdotally, it feels like when he's addressed the team in the past, there's been a little more of a pause between response. And so that's like incremental growth of trust. Trust is gained in drops and lost in buckets. Like that's, I firmly live by that. And so that's like that idea there. The other part of what you mentioned that I think is interesting, this whole season was kind of like everyone taking a step back and doing the work on their own a bit. The one person that applies to most, and I know we keep mentioning, you know, the person not in the room here in Spencer Hall who loves up on him often, but this season was about Isaac's growth in a lot of way. The best teams are led inside the locker room, and Isaac finally like took over the mantle in a real way this year. It was about it being Isaac's team and then Ted coming back in the right moment here. And I think, like, again, in the pantheon of things in the sports world that this gets right, is some of like, even the Christmas episode that was an offshoot, like those things are things that matter when you're building a team, these like moments to connect with each other off the pitch, you know, all the stuff with the text message bonding when, you know, Sam was flirting unknowingly with Rebecca on banter, and then all the way up to just this steady progression of Isaac becoming more and more of the figure for this locker room. Like those are all things, if you are building a healthy team that is eventually going to have the kind of on-field success we see back in this episode, they make sense. And they bring it along at a really like gradual, understandable pace.
And not to belabor the, I watched the whole thing again, but if you remember in season one, Colin and Isaac were the two that picked on Nate and were the ones that they had to be, you know, that were Jamie's, you know, cronies that would do whatever he wanted. And to see that full growth into what also could have been, I guess I'll put it umbrella under my favorite scene, but the scene in the locker room at halftime where he's like, Kathy,
Caroline,
you're doing
my job for me, because I was going to lead you right into that.
Yeah.
And all on this wavelength
instincts.
Right now.
Yeah. And he, and, I think it's Cola Bikini. I'm hopefully saying his name correctly, but he's fantastic in the role, both like in the actual acting and physically. He's a wonderful physical actor because of using his size, and you kind of also just see his charm in the hair cutting scene. Like the beauty of that scene is just an independent, like exactly what Mike said, like showing the development of this team growing together. And these are guys that, you know, didn't like each other necessarily to start, whether it's just because of Jamie or didn't like it when Jamie came back or had their own issues and were losing. And, you know, Isaac was even pointing fingers at teammates being like, we lost because of this, like Jan Maas, you need to fix this, like, you know, throwing the chair at the TV and the oops in it. So just like seeing all that growth culminate in him kind of literally, he bodied through the huddle. And to see Ted kind of step back and have that moment of he's doing his job because he has the buy-in, but also the culture and the leader among the players, and the beautiful moment of how uncomfortable that made Nate. And Nate kind of had a little bit of a mini history with the Believe thing, because, you know, if you think back to the Man City game, he was really annoyed when Ted went to get it out of the bath. He's like, you have it in your bathroom? Like, what does this do with it? Like, and that kind of, again, these through lines that connect everything. So that scene, it just, yeah, Isaac McAdoo was chef's kiss. This, like, he was wonderful.
Awesome.
Yeah.
He's awesome. He also introduced the word bruv to me, which I'll
forever
appreciate.
In it,
Alex,
bruv.
Alex, in we it. Saw copyright infringement, bruv.
Yeah, yes. Well, my refrigerator has a television.
Alex, season one, episode one, we saw Ted hang that Believe sign. 22 hours, close to 22 hours of TV later, we see Isaac lead that team to tap the Believe sign. I would say the most, I mean, in you know, picking one moment in the series to say this gave me the chills the most, but arguably gave me the chills more than anything, was seeing the team Isaac started and then the whole team go in there, and me to be emotionally invested in that with every fiber of my being. There wasn't an ounce of cheesy or this was credit earned. This was something that this show put the effort into to make this moment hit. They could have done that shit at the end of season one, would not have felt the same as it did after all this, even with little whiny ass fucking Nate just souring the moment. But it was still beautiful.
Yeah. So I have a lot of opinions about the believe sign. First of all, I forced my trainer to put one above the door at our fitness studio because I forced him to watch the show. Naturally, I have to bully everyone into
what?
It.
What? I'm shocked.
Can you believe
strong-arm and someone into watching the show?
But what's amazing is like my trainer is basically Ted Lasso. Like I had never used a trainer until last December. I always did cardio, right? And I swear I'm not going to get in the weeds on this, but I was like, you know, I was always intimidated by weights and everything else. And I came to him and I didn't want somebody who was a drill sergeant to me. I just wanted to get stronger. And it's been this incredible year of like discovering my own strength, realizing I'm actually kind of a badass when it comes to like leg presses and stuff. Who knew? And so it's awesome to realize how strong you are and you didn't even know it, because I had decided my whole life, I'm clumsy. I'm a band member. I'm not athletic at all. And it's like, actually, I can do some of this stuff. So I had him put that believe sign up there. And at first it was kind of a joke, but some days when it's really hard, like it's the only thing that keeps me going, and I don't want to jump ahead here, but the reaction I had when I saw the ripped believe sign, I started weeping. It was the first time in the show I started crying, because it just devastated me. And I read something where somebody, I've never seen a Star War, but someone compared it to like,
not a single war.
Not a single Star War.
There's been so many and you haven't seen a single Star War.
Someone compared it to like, what was it? Like cutting off, was it Darth Vader's hand or Luke Skywalker's hand or something? There was some like pivotal moment.
Part of this episode.
The nerds are going right? to fucking kill us for this.
But someone, I'm going to get so much.
Which one of those fucking aliens did get his hand cut off?
Jar Jar Binks, I think, did it.
They were having a war among the stars, and like someone.
It'd be such a shame if like Star Wars blogs picked this up and just had a million Star Wars fans listen. It would really suck. I really hope. Star Wars fans don't listen.
But it is like that moment, right? And I think of like those kind of moments in movies that people always go back to. Like this is a terrible example, but like in Titanic when everyone's like there was room for Jack on the raft. There are just certain things that you've seen that just stay with you forever. Seeing that ripped sign destroyed something in me, and I did not realize how attached I was to it and what it represented and how it's kind of led us to this finale until I saw that. And it goes to, I mean, you know, when you think about the title of the episode, Inverting the Pyramid of Success. So you have the pyramid of success. Obviously, we have this great scene where Nate's like looking at it and not really caring because he doesn't believe in any of the teamwork stuff. He just believes in like, go, go, go and make people suffer and you get a paycheck and you need to, you know, he's not really into fostering relationships. And we know that. And then we have Beard reading Inverting the Pyramid, which is just about like the history of soccer and how it evolved over the years. And so you have this contrast between this game is just about the game. And actually, like, you know, Nate claims you wouldn't have won a match without me, as if what Ted has been building since day one doesn't matter. And that's just not true. We see that. We know they work together. We saw it happen in the last game. And I just, this was rambling, but I think that sign represents so much about who Ted is and how, even though he's still somehow clueless about soccer, it still works. And I don't think they wouldn't want to match without that teamwork, without that idea that they're going to support each other.
Nate doesn't understand that sports is so much more than tactics and athletes. And we're going to get into where we think that's going to get him, you know, in charge of his own club. But I want to talk about the Ted-Nate confrontation, which gave me such like a guttural anger hearing him talk to Ted like that. It was petty. It was very insecure. It was just a very small thing, but it was clearly out of, you know, deep seated. It wasn't just about Ted. It wasn't all that. He was talking to his dad. He was talking to everyone who ever picked on him.
Yeah.
He was talking to his deep, deep insecure issues that I mean, go way beyond, you know, feeling threatened when Roy Kent walked onto the assistant pitch, or being worried about, you know, not getting credit, or, you know, vice versa or anything like that. It was it was one of the most deeply upsetting things I've seen on this show. That confrontation was very raw, yeah. And it made me, I mean, Caroline, when Nate ripped into our precious Ted, the man who, if not for Ted, Nate is still getting picked on every single day of his life.
Look, it's one of those, like, I want to walk a very fine line of, like, not wanting to, there are things that Nate definitely experienced that I think the biggest things to me that stood out that would be the microaggressions, if you want to call, but the slights that that were visible to us as the viewers. There was a moment after Jamie scored that really faraway goal that Nate went to, like, high five or hug him, and he went to hug Roy first because that was Roy's idea with the signal and the double birds and, like, getting Jamie to be more selfish and be that asshole Jamie. And so then he came back and, like, high five, but that alone to Nate was enough to feel, because there were even little things that didn't happen that I think if they had would have given Nate more of a, I won't even say a leg to stand on, because you're right, he was petty and cruel and took things way beyond any of the, even if it was perceived slights that he got from Ted. Like, so when Roy showed up, he went to the end. He went past Nate. He was number four. Like, there was no, he didn't adjust himself in to bump Nate down. Like, Nate had this feeling, this innate feeling, because of his insecurities, that he was now the low man on the totem pole, when in reality, there was not a lot of instances where he was treated that way by anyone on the coaching staff. Because when Rebecca praised them for the parking the bus and that leading to the run out goal, that all that stuff, Roy immediately goes, oh, that wasn't me. That was all Nate. That was Nate's idea. Obviously there were the people talking about the Roy Kent effect that had this big impact on Nate and thinking that he wasn't good enough. And there was a moment where, you know, oh, we need to call in the big dogs. And Nate was like, okay, fine, I'll do it. And Ted laughed and he was like, oh, I didn't realize you're, and he did apologize in the moment, but clearly that meant so much more to Nate because he said, you're not the big dog, you gotta go to Roy. Even though Roy was the right guy for that situation. That's the stuff that Nate refused to see. And there's the other things that he didn't see, like the feeling that all he has in his office are these, like, you know, generic American sayings about cliches in sports, and you don't even have the picture I gave you, like, you asshole, like, all this stuff. And it's sitting on his dresser in his room at home next to a picture of his son. So, like, in some of the stuff, I think Ted couldn't have headed off this explosion, because the one big example was what led to Nate apologizing to the team and Ted going, do I need to know about this? And Nate goes, no, or Beard goes, no, it's handled, because it was the way he talked to Colin. It's the way he talked to Will. And he was so worried about, as someone who's, like, grown up being like, my family's a tough crowd, y'all. You gotta be ready. Like, you gotta dish it out. You're gonna get it. Nate was always ready to dish it out. And he always went cruel fast. And there were examples of that over time that if you went back and thought about it or watched it, like, immediately calling Rebecca a shrew when he thought he was fired. Other instances where he just goes real cruel, real fast, that when it's the roast before the game that they won in Liverpool against, I think it was Everton, it was funny and people thought it was this, like, him coming out of his shell, but all the stuff he said was, like, really pointed and personal. And it just kind of goes to show that, like, they wanted to have fun with him and cajole or take the piss, as they say, like, with the Wonder Kid jersey. And Nate, they don't do that with people if they don't like them. That's what he misses. Like, if they don't interact with you or don't joke with you, that's when you know you're in trouble. Like, you don't get picked on. And there's obviously levels to it. When he's getting thrown in the cart over the first season, like, that's a different level of camaraderie. But I'm definitely rambling now. But there was just so much that he didn't understand or didn't see and look through it from that lens of being so insecure. And Nick Mohammed played it beautifully, because I want to punch Nate in the face. Like, I legit, like, hate him. And so that means the actor did a great job, but it just was, there were so many little things that he misread, and rather than trying to figure that out, he completely burned that bridge.
He was, like, judgmental and not curious.
Yes. 100%.
And Nick Muhammad's show notes about this that he tweeted out are really exciting and illustrative read. But and it's so weird because my immediate reaction was that, like, it was, this is an incredible performance in that mood. Like, I mean, him angrily wiping away the tears and like,
oh, yeah.
Alex, it really hit me when you talked about The Sign, because like I went to college at a place that believes in a lot of symbols, one of which is a sign. And the one thing I kind of realized after the fact was the symbols never meant as much to me as the people I associated with the symbols. And so when I saw The Sign, I was like, that's a hurt person. Like, that's a really broken person. And all of the things that Nate got, like, this is another thing I was talking to Nicole and Spencer about, was you see a lot of this in sports where how people come up matters a lot in what they become. And Nate had to eat a lot of shit from a lot of people. Like, he did not get, cause I'm Caroline, I'm with you. Like, the love language, it's like the saying, like, when a coach stops being hard on you and stops coaching you, that's when you need to worry, because that means they don't care anymore.
Yeah.
But Nate never got like that loving stuff. It was always from a very cruel place with Nate. And so the minute he gets power, you see the way he flips on all that. You see the way it changes. And that moment where Ted and the big dog thing, that was the first spot where I knew Ted wasn't right this season. Because Ted in season one does not miss that opportunity. Ted in season two is going through his own shit.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden there misses a very like clear, like, oh, he needs this moment. He at least needs to feel like he's not being belittled in this spot. And so like all of that just swirls. And like, you see his relationship with his dad, like Nate's never gotten the love that is the foundation to being able to dish it. Like, he only knows the love language of the locker room in his mind is getting shit in a way that is not healthy or productive. And so that's why he dishes it out so clearly there. So just seeing all that, like, juxtaposed with, and it really hit home for me when Sam had his moment, when Sam was in the locker room, because Sam is this portrait of what sports can do for a healthy ego. When he looks up and says, I have defined myself way too, I'm paraphrasing, but I've defined myself way too long by how other people feel about me, and I need to do what's best for me. He is operating in a way where, like, God, in the purest form of sports, it empowers you to feel better about yourself and more comfortable about yourself in ways that few other things can, because it is a crucible where conflict breeds results. That is why Isaac is so important in this, and that's why Ted and what happens with Nate is so weird, because they let it simmer for a long time. It is passive aggressive in a way that sports conflict is not. And so when you finally get to this point, it's like, oh man, it boils over the top, because Nate has not done the work, because Nate is constantly, whether it is through Twitter, whether it's through everyone on this team, has defined, whether it's through Ted being kind to him in season one, has defined his self-worth. When he asked Keeley about how to be famous, like, he is constantly defining his self-worth through how other people view him. And Sam is the perfect juxtaposition for him. And it makes this all so clear to where, yeah, I still want to punch Nate in the face, but like, the more and more I sit with it, I'm like, damn, this person is like so broken by the way life has treated them. And just, he's the one that's this season, like, as we watched everyone do the work, Nate didn't do the work along the way. He sat there and he ingested poison, and now he is reaping the benefits of that poison.
Yeah, but there's so much pity still there. Like, for us, like, I still pity Nate as a person. You see how broken he is in this conversation. It's gross, the things he says to Ted. Like, it sucks, but there's still pity in there. And you mentioned Sam, you mentioned the powerful step he takes in this episode in a couple ways, but the conversation he has with his dad before that, and his dad wasn't, what I loved about that conversation, his dad wasn't forcing a decision on him either way. He wasn't telling him to come home. He wasn't telling him, you need to stay in the Premier League and do this. It was just basically like, man, you do what you feel is right. And it was, but he has supported Sam. He has given him positive reinforcement throughout the season. This show, think about the parents they have shown us. Again, everything's intentional. They have shown us Sam's relationship with his dad. They have shown us Jamie's relationship with his dad. We have gotten insight into Ted's relationship with his dad. The parental relationship, they have laid the groundwork for how important that is. And Nate, we have seen the relationship with his dad. And then we have seen that Ted has kind of, in the first season, very much a father figure to Nate. And father figure to Nate and Jamie, actually, there's that parallel, But one has, Jamie is getting the things that Nate was searching for in other places in his life, whereas Nate was just constantly, Nate got like the taste from Ted of that adoration and that relationship with his father that he has probably craved since, I mean, his father drove off his first girlfriend, told her she could do better, like all that stuff. And so this show has lined that up from the start. Like we have the seed of why Nate is so craving, and it, you know, maybe it's not just all just issues with his dad, but they gave us those scenes intentionally. The episode with the restaurant, the episode after when his dad is reading the paper and doesn't say shit to him about the game. Like, that is very, very, very intentional.
The suit and, stuff, too. Is that the suit Ted got you?
Yes.
Like, that was a through line that, you know, and Jan Maas always exacerbates things when he's like, Dutch. Oh, that's infantilizing, isn't it? And he's like, you didn't buy all my clothes. But it's
Zero,
just, you know,
you should have saved that first goal.
Yeah, so he's like, hey, but you know, and it's the thing that always, it stood out too, because he made this big thing about like, oh, now you want to give me credit when it's not going to work, when that's where I was like, this is literally just an angry, hurt person lashing out, because none of that is rooted in truth. Like, they've given him credit for all the good ideas and all the good stuff that he's thought up and promoted.
We were running
him and made
Nate's
him.
False nine. He only sees that as a bad thing because he sees the bad thing of, oh, if it doesn't work, you're gonna blame it on me. Which, like, if you've seen Ted, you know he doesn't operate like that.
No.
He is the pillar of accepting responsibility.
And he's like, the thing when they were making their, like, thing, you know, where Beard was like, I coached a game high because I drank some tea. Nate's was, I don't actually come up with these things spontaneously. I think about them a lot and then just present them at the right time. And it's that insight to the calculation side of his brain where he is, all like Mike said, always doing things to make himself look better, look smarter, look funnier, all of these things that he plans out. And it's the, you know, I think all of us has done it, scrolling Twitter, and you have like, you know, you'll get 55 tweets that say nice things about the show you just did, and you get one person that's like, you idiot, and that's the one that bothers you. Like, that's the one you latch onto, that's the one that you like let simmer, and you're like, look what this person said. And that's, you see that when he sees someone say like, I still think this guy's a loser, that's when he goes in to see Will and is like, don't you ever embarrass me again, like, da 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 da. And so I get, like, I could talk about Nate forever, because I agree, like, as much as I do want to punch him in the nose, like, Beard's like, I'll headbutt you right now. Oh shit, we didn't even talk about that part.
I know,
that was such a big moment where it's like, he tells Roy that he kissed Keely right after Roy says he wants to like rip Jamie's face off, but he forgave him, and he goes, that's okay, you didn't mean it. Like, it was that, you're not even a threat to me when it comes to my relationship, that I know you're just sweet little Nate. And I don't think Roy meant it in this mean, condescending way, but to Nate, it's, again, it's the big dog thing, the same thing, but like, you're not even mad I kissed your girlfriend. Jamie talked to her and you want to kill him. I kissed her and you're like, that's fine. Like, that was such a huge moment.
I'm 5'7", so I can say this. Nate has such a severe case of short man syndrome. It's just, I mean, it just radiates from it. Alex, go ahead.
No, I just, you know, we've talked a lot about how Nate has interpreted a lot of these microaggressions against him, and not that some of them aren't valid, but just like that moment, he perceives it as Roy not seeing him as a threat. Roy's upset about Jamie because Keely was with Jamie.
Yeah.
Like, that's an old boyfriend. That is a bigger threat. Nate could be the hottest, most confident guy on earth. She still didn't date him. And I think, like, there are a lot of moments like that, and especially in Nate's monologue, they were like, oh, he's totally misinterpreted a lot of this. And he's not even considering, like, to him, Ted's panic attack was a sign that he wasn't fit to coach, which is why he leaked it ultimately. He's not even thinking about the implications of that, and that Ted might be acting differently because he's really struggling with anxiety. I think, you know, the biggest thing for me about Nate is, and I'm not one of those people that's like, I don't minimize people's trauma or anything. I don't think we should compare trauma, but I do think there's that point where, and it takes being emotionally healthy to handle this, where you have to look at it and say, all of these things happened to me and they were unfair. And it shouldn't have happened. And I didn't deserve it. And you have a choice. You can either be so resentful that other people have to suffer for what happened to you for the rest of your life, including yourself, or you say, it's my responsibility to pick up the pieces, even if it wasn't my fault. you know? And I think Nate is not there yet. I think Jamie was there. I think Jamie realized I was a dick. I think he realized this season my dad really did a number on me, but at no point did he crumble and say, well, like, I'm going to continue being a dick because my dad did this to me. Like, he did the work, and doing the work has been such a big theme.
I do think with Ted too, especially though, like, this is kind of the burden of leadership and the way he's adopted. Like, I heard you guys talk about on here how Ted always did a really good job of like meeting people where they are. Like, part of leadership is understanding you can't coach everybody the same. And one of the themes of this season, especially with Doc, was this idea of she wasn't going to connect with Ted until she opened up to him some. And we saw Ted with basically every other person that we've talked about here have those emotive moments where there was some sort of connection there. And again, to go back to Nick Mohammed's show notes, this is the first scene alone that Ted and Nate have had since he apologized for snapping at him in the hotel that one night. Like, yeah, there hasn't That's been crazy. That connective yeah. tissue with these two when you think about the way they've set that up. So it's just like, again, in the way that this show like doesn't do anything on accident here, like, you've seen Ted have those moments where even with the team right there, like, opening up to them in that way, the way, like, all of it across here, like, leadership and that connection requires giving something of yourself. And like, that's, again, it's not to excuse Nate, because you're right, there's things that he has done wrong in here, but it is, you know, in just looking at, again, Ted had stuff of his own to deal with this season. So you're going to miss things in that process.
He couldn't even enjoy the fact that his strategy did work. Like, that was so devastating to me, that in all of that, he actually was successful. And the fact that at halftime, he was saying that, again, he never took responsibility. My tactic is sound. These idiots just don't know how to play soccer. Like, basically was his, like, he's like, if these guys knew how to play, this wouldn't be an issue. Like, my thing was brilliant. And even when it did work, he was so mad and selfish. I don't know if selfish is the right word, but you know what I mean? Like, that he was so self-centered in that moment that he couldn't even enjoy the fact that they just got promoted in this big moment for the club, because he was so overcome with that anger and sadness and hurt, that it was, again, it's all brilliant. Just like seeing that pan out, and how that was devastating to me, that like, buddy, like, you're, everyone actually wants you there. Like, none of them hate you. They all, like, maybe Beard does now, but I mean, like, they
Beard
wanted
is coming
to
for that ass.
Yeah. When Beard's face, when he said he kissed, when he was like, just, oh man, he did some excellent face, and as always, face acting for a moment.
I think now is probably a good time just to kind of talk about Nate, where we last see him. He has been given the job by King Scumbag Rupert.
So he is the head coach, right? Like, he gave him the head coaching job at West Ham. Okay.
Yeah, appears like the way he's that look in his eye, it looks like he is the head guy at West Ham. There's no chance that Rupert respects Nate as a person whatsoever, would respect his authority on anything, see him an equal. Nate was his former kit man when Rupert owned AFC Richmond. And you know who talks in professional sports is players. I mean, sports in general, players talk. There will be the word out on Nate on how he handles things. Players will, you know, players will communicate. The media will talk. Nate is, I can't think of anyone less able to handle British tabloids and that kind of press and that kind of heat that Ted took than Nate. And the style, you know, I think it was Mike talking earlier about, you know, Nate, Alex was talking about her trainer. She didn't want a drill sergeant. Nate is a fucking drill sergeant. When we last see West Ham United, they look like the, you know, like Caroline said, the team from the Mighty Ducks. Nate is a guy who I see him rolling into that and not getting any of the things he's looking for besides unlimited power. But I don't think that, you know, Alex, you correct me if I'm wrong here, I don't think that power is going to be what he thinks it's going to be.
Well, it isn't for anyone, is it? Like, when we are in pursuit of things that are so fleeting and so relative, and like, he's always going to want more because he uses this one metric to measure his success. And again, we know he thinks being that drill sergeant and everything that happens on the field is everything that happens in the sport. Like, he has no way out of that. So to him, it's just ascending to new heights, and it's never going to be enough, because once you've decided, and Nate has clearly decided, he suffered for as long as he did because people had power over him. So now he has power and he's going to want more of it and more of it and more of it until he has a breaking point where he learns like you're never going to be satisfied if you're depending on everyone else in the world to tell you who you are.
Mike, your thoughts on Nate rolling into that program, assuming that team of professional athletes, my understanding, again, I do not follow Premier League. West Ham United, like, seems to be a solid group of chaps. They seem to be good at the old sport of football.
Bunch of bruvs over there.
Bunch of solid bruvs just kicking that ball around.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned there about him just rolling in and expecting to be respected here, like, that is the literal inverted pyramid that we see in the locker room, because what's on the top of that pyramid is competitive greatness. And what's on the bottom of that pyramid is loyalty, friendship, and cooperation. A drill sergeant can work. I played the best coach I have ever played for on any level of sports outside of my dad was a drill sergeant. And the only reason it worked is because I knew that guy was bought in and wanted the best for me. And he proved that over and over again. And so there was mutual buy-in. And once there's mutual buy-in, and I'm for you and you are for me, you can say it however you want. I know what's at the root of it. I can deal with that. Nate is not going to do that. Nate's going to commit the cardinal sin of every locker room. And when you think about what's going on, like to bring it to sports out in, you know, in the current world right now, when you think about some of what's going on in Jacksonville with Urban Meyer and some of what I always go back to this example of David Blatt in Cleveland with the Cavaliers, which is you can have success somewhere else. It's not here. You have got to come and show us, not tell us what you're about and earn that every day. Like it's the mantra of being like a freshman on any team or a rookie. Like I always thought, seen, not heard. I want you to see how I work. I don't need to tell you how I work or anything else and all of that. Nate is going to come in and demand respect, he thinks, immediately because of the position that he's been given and because he thinks he is some sort of wunderkind. That is not going to fly in that locker room. Like that is very quickly going to be undone because there's no foundation built there based on like what we've all talked about here. Like Alex and her trainer, like any of us in sports, like the foundation is shared struggle and you're not going to have that. You're just going to have someone who comes in and expect it to all be his because he's been named in that position. Because like he yelled at Ted, he thinks he has earned this just by way of starting from where he did, not based on the relationships he makes along the way.
Well, and you said wanting the same thing, you know, a drill sergeant, you guys have to want the same thing. You have to want that win. Nate doesn't want that. Richmond completes this miracle season. They get back to the Premier League, but Nate didn't want that shit. He wanted it to be about him. He wanted them to win on his terms. He wanted the credit for that. That's not going to fly. That's not the drill sergeant. That's not wanting the same thing. He doesn't want it all the same thing as any of those players. Like Caroline, when you see, you know, Nate rolling into that locker room, how fast does he lose the locker room?
I mean, this is going to depend so much on who his assistants are, right? Who are the guys that are running them through those drills as he walks, he turns and walks towards the camera. Like
they look like big fucking dudes. I won't lie.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. and that's, I mean, it all depends. And it's one of those, like, I kind of like, not to go back to Mighty Ducks, but I would love, there has to be a moment in season 3 where they lose to West Ham. Like there has to. I kind of want, when I say the Mighty Ducks thing, is I want, or green, or, you know, Big Green, or pick any Little Giants, whatever you want, pick any kid sport movie where they lose to the team dressed in all black in a moment where like that thinks that gets them all the power and all the, you know, we're the machine and like we've figured it out. We have the money. We have like, you know, Rupert ass face, whatever. That it's going to come back, and in a pivotal moment, it's all going to fall apart for Nate. I think I could be completely wrong. Like, who knows if they'll do the show, because they don't go cliche. Who knows? But I think that we're going to see Nate have some success, and he thinks that he's doing it the right way. And really, it's like fool's gold, and it's all going to fall apart because he doesn't do any of the things that we talked about establishing culture and establishing respect and rapport, and they'll see through him immediately because he says stuff to people like what he said to Colin. I cannot get over what he said to Colin about being the art at a Holiday Inn that covers the blood stain on the wall. You're just there to be there. And that's the stuff that you can't win anyone over like that, let alone a locker room that needs to rely on each other and all that. It's just, it's going to be, I think it's such a bad idea. Like how does Rupert sell that?
Well, Caroline, I think you're exactly right, though, is they're good enough and well-funded enough to where it's going to go well for a while. Like, all the things I said, we know this. I mean, this is sports. Winning covers up all the nasty stuff that goes on here. But then you get to a situation where you get a stress test and you play someone good and flush the pipes, and there's going to be water spraying everywhere then.
Yeah. I just think it's going to – it has to come to some point where they face each other. I think just the dramatic side of it, that he, if he gets a win and thinks, is, you know, this is something that he's bested Ted, and Ted's this backwoods American, still doesn't get it, I'm the master tactician, only for Ted to come through in the bigger moment, I think would be so awesome. I'm here for it.
Something Alex and I talked about, and I've talked about a few times, is that I think Ted's finest moment as a coach in the last two seasons, breaking my own rule, I'm talking about the seasons and everything is in their entirety. But I think one of Ted's, I think Ted's finest moment was the season one finale. It's handling the moment of a loss, of a devastating loss. It is fucking easy to win. Anyone can do that. Not physically, but like the emotions of handling a win when things are going well for you, it is easy. What Ted does with that team that is so devastated, has suffered as devastating a loss as you can imagine. Jamie Tartt, remember when we hated that guy pretty well?
I know, right?
I know. I never hated Jamie.
Shay. You're so Shay.
But how Ted rallies that team, makes them feel, makes us feel at the end of that. That's the thing that the good coaches can do. Even the drill sergeants, they can empathize, they can care. Cause if you all want it just as bad, if you want the same thing, it's going to hurt the same. And acknowledging that hurt, and acknowledging that your players are human, that this is a fucking game. And Nate just does not have any of that in him. He doesn't. I mean, I think that's his biggest fault as a person right now. And Alex, I mean, you know, you're the best to speak on this as far as human emotions feeling, but I think Nate's lack of empathy might be right now his scariest trait.
I really thought you were going to go from like, you're the best to speak on people who are the worst.
I mean, you're just the best to speak on everything. People always ask me like, what, you know, hey, what should I do to get into podcasting? Like, one, care about what you're going to do. Two, get a co-host who's way fucking smarter than you.
I know a lot about like three things. That's Ted Lasso, playing the flute. I'll come up with a third thing later. Gas station food. There we go. And that's it. No. So I, you know, and I realize I tie everything back to parenting just because that's like my whole life. So, you know, you're raising a little boy and little boys are rambunctious and they're always going and doing, and you get in these patterns of stop, don't do that. Don't run. Don't, you know, and to them, they get to the age where they're just like, stop it. Stop telling me no all the time. And so I guess it was about a year ago that I started changing my approach with him. So, and this is just an example, like if he was running down the hall, instead of saying, don't do that, stop doing that, I would say, listen, if you run down the hall, you could fall and get really hurt. And that would make me very sad. And it really like changed the tone. And like in the morning, for example, because he hates getting up, he doesn't want to go to school. Amazing. Instead of being like, well, you have to go to school because you're a kid and that's what you have to do. Now, every morning, I wake him up. He says the same thing every day. I'm too tired to do it. And I always say, me too. Like, I know. I don't want to go to work either, bud. But we're in this together and we're going to do it. And it just changes the tone of the day. And I'm certainly not a model mother or whatever. But I just think like that small thing of showing you have your rules and you have your approach to people because you're invested in them and their safety and their well-being. And I think it can just totally change the tone, whether it's a team or parenting or friends or any sort of relationship. When it's like what Miss Bowen said in the first or second episode, when they, you know, they lost the finals or whatever, the little girl team. And she's like, you know, I had a coach who was an asshole too, but it didn't matter to me as long as I knew he gave a shit. And that kind of set everything up, didn't it?
Yes.
It really always did. God, they don't.
They don't miss.
They don't miss. You know what?
By the way, Alex.
Go ahead, Mike.
I was just going to say, Alex's quote too about little boys reminded me about Ted's quote about little girls. Little girls are serious, silly, so and powerful. I gave up trying to figure them out years ago.
It's true, though.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh my God. We talk about they don't miss. They don't leave anything unanswered, whatever. We do have the biggest question of season three to talk about. Why was Phoebe drawing boobs?
I know,
I'm still like, they didn't. That's completely. What if they don't? What if that's the only
thing? It's gonna haunt Kyle forever.
And, yeah, and then I'm like, I'm deep on Reddit threads. Like, what did Bill Lawrence mean?
I have a theory. And again, I got to put on the mom hat. When you're a single mother, like Phoebe's mother is, and you have a young child, they don't just sit nicely in the living room when you have to take a shower or if you're doing something. They're just in your business all the time. And so my theory is, especially with a mother and a daughter, is like, I'm sure there's just been times like her mom's got to take a shower and she's sitting in there with her. And, you know, I think like she's probably been exposed to that. My first thought was like, oh, she must have seen Keely or something, but Keely has a tattoo on her rib. So, you know, that doesn't work out. But that's just my feeling is like, we haven't explored the relationship we had that she has with her mom. We know that she's an ER doctor. Like she works all the time. We know her dad's a piece of shit.
Piece of shit.
I know.
living piece of shit.
But there's nothing to suggest she has a bad relationship with her mom. And so I hope we get into that more honestly next season is like, I'm sure just like living with your mom and she's got to get stuff done and she can't wait on you to be cool with sitting in the other room while she takes a shower.
I also, as a kid, I was the one that I wanted to be a doctor. And so I had like one of those dramatic, like Dorling Kindersley encyclopedia of the body. Yeah. So like maybe Phoebe's just doing extra, like, you know, reading up on biology and decided.
I don't know. That's something they're going to need to answer for my own personal sanity. With season three, have we seen the last of Edwin Akufu? I feel like miming a shit over a dummy is kind of like a see ya, sir. I really like that they made that choice because I like that we can feel good about Sam's choice. I love watching him buy the Sam. I love that he didn't do it for Rebecca. He did it for him, like Mike was saying earlier. And right away we see like, man, really good call. Edwin Akufu got a shitting thing. Like he's got some things he needs to work out.
Got a shitting thing.
how did he not break down laughing? How many takes do you think that took?
So like many.
When he's just describing, like, I'm going to shit in every room of your childhood home, burn it to the ground.
And then shit on the ashes
as I eat Nigerian food.
Was that a weird homage to Shooter McGavin, by the way? Because that's almost word for word, but with a different bodily function. The threat he made to Happy Gilmore. I'm going to buy grandma's house, burn it to the ground, and then piss on the ashes.
Yes. True.
There's another good Major League homage in this one too. Roy headbutting Jamie and then giving him the hug right after. That is very much so Dorn punching Rick Vaughn and then them embracing after.
The jumping in the circle celebrating with like Roy and Jamie was also just top notch. Oh my God. Sam Richardson though should get, I mean, first of all, I'm already so biased. I got to be on the Emmy episode, so everyone's heard my thoughts on how everything should win every Emmy. But I mean, I don't know how you don't like Jason Sudeikis knocked everything out of the park, but you got to give Sam Richardson some sort of guest appearance thing or something because that was fantastic. Sam Richardson is so funny and just that scene. And then the handshake thing from the handshake guy.
Like, it's so good.
Oh, it was brilliant. It was beautiful.
So good. Is there anything we haven't talked? You know what? There is. Higgins's conversation with Keely when she goes to him. Again, I feel like every we get towards the end of an episode and it's like, fuck, we forgot to talk about Higgins and all the great Higgins things he did. The smile allergy, the rare smile allergy. Tell me more, sir.
But well, the Denzel Washington, like, yeah.
The head nod. Oh,
I saw
fuck,
it in a Denzel
cool.
Washington movie and thought, ooh, I'm taking that.
But I want to talk about the quote, a good mentor hopes you will move on. A great mentor knows you will. The Higgins advice, the Rebecca Keeley conversation, like that relationship, that felt it felt really good. And it's something that we've had a lot of, I think it was Corey, our good friend Corey, who guested for episode 10, talking about how Keely has taken this, Alex, you go into that a little bit better, but how Keely was, her whole life was kind of, she was famous, and then suddenly she was working for this team, doing stuff for everyone else, and finally gets this chance to move on and really do her own thing and really, you know, strive for her dreams. And thankfully for us, is met with nothing but support. Like, that was so rewarding to see.
Yeah, well, I think it's important too, and I know I've said this a million times, they never pitted Keely and Rebecca against each other. Like, even when Rebecca didn't really know her that well, and she, you know, the whole lion and panda thing, they made them friends from the start, which is important because it's always the trope, right? If two women, especially two beautiful women, they've got to be fighting with each other all the time. It's an interesting dynamic because, and Caroline and I have talked about this. So Caroline and I worked together at SB Nation. And the way we literally got to know each other is she would write these Bachelor recaps and needed an editor for it. And I had never seen The Bachelor, still haven't. And I was like, I'll do it, but I don't know what's going on. And so we'd go back and forth and she'd explain The Bachelor and we just became wonderful friends. And for the first time in my life, when all the layoffs went down and I had to leave, for the first time in my entire career, I was sad to leave a coworker behind because I had developed this relationship with her. Now, I want to go on the record as saying I did not hire Caroline to work with me. So no nepotism here, folks. But the fact that it worked out to where we're able to work together again, and it's, you know, an equal relationship. We don't, it's not a boss employee thing. Like, we're having the time of our lives. It's really great to have somebody who you know is in your corner. And even though, you know, work relationships can get tricky, it's the first time in my life I ever had like a Keely Rebecca thing. And so I think it affects me more. I know, right? This is our time to cry. But when Rebecca says some advice on being a boss, hire your best friend, I felt that.
I did too. I immediately texted her.
Don't cry.
This is like, I mean, because it is, it's, and again, with that bookends thing, this was another moment, like she said, with the panda lion thing. She's like, you turn this panda into a lion. And just that, again, like finding, thankfully it's not this series finale, but there were these nice balancing moments throughout. And it was just such a beautiful, sweet, like, and so I thought so realistic, because the crying where you're genuinely sad that you're not going to see this person or work with them anymore, but also at the same time, like, legitimately could not be more excited for their opportunity. And it was just such a realistic, like, relatable thing that I thought, again, was done so just like, you're gonna make me cry again, like, just and I do love every time Higgins gives advice, it's generally like, really, it's like bad, amazing, like, he's just working his way around. Then he's like, oh, you're scared about telling her. He's like, oh, you came to me. She's like, well, Ted and Roy are at practice and I'm scared it's about telling Rebecca.
It's amazing, like, Rebecca's support, like, how positive that conversation was for both of them and how happy. I mean, I don't want to make this episode too emotional. Mike, I remember specifically the last radio show you did with your dad that was on. I remember watching it, and you both said incredibly just the kindest things to each other. And it was clear that relationship, it was father son, but also the working relationship that you guys were able to build. And I think it's a similar thing that we saw there. And I think you can kind of speak to that of what that means to work with someone who you also have a deep, deep relationship with. There's probably a sense of never wanting that to end, but also wanting the best for that person as well.
Yeah. So it's interesting with the dad part of things here, because I've now been at ESPN just long enough to have formed relationships with other people who are leaving too. And so the part with my dad that I said there that holds the most true is, like, that's still my dad. Like, I can still pick up the phone and that guy's there for me for the rest of my life. And, you know, that's
telling
always
you to change
be
your air filter.
Yes, exactly. Which now I have an alarm for every 6 months to change my air filter. Dad, your advice has seeped in over time. I have slowly become you in all of the, like, smallest, most minute ways. I love you. Thank you for all that. So, like, that's all going to be there. And I've said over and over again, like, I won't have a thing in my professional life that touches being able to work with my dad. But again, like, I have that selfish thing of, like, he's still mine. Everyone else, there is kind of, like, what Alex described and what we saw in the scene. Like, it feels like a little bit of a loss when people leave the nest. And I was talking to my friend Nicole, who works at ESPN, about, you know, just some of the other people that have left the company since, you know, I've been here 6 years now. So some of the other people that have left the company that were young and were there when I got here. And it's Kayla Johnson, who, you know, now is doing a great job, who's making her directorial debut. She works over it together. She's doing a documentary that she directed about a young woman who started the Renegade Dance on TikTok and all these different things. And we were all, you know, retweeting Kayla's trailer. Like, Kayla's like the best teammate on earth and like doing all these great things. And so, you know, you saw this outpouring of people doing all this. And I was talking to Nicole about this because she was the one that kind of told me, hey, this is coming out. We want to support this. And she just sort of like said it flippantly, but I kind of stopped and have been sitting with it for the rest of the day. She's like, what's the point of coming up together if we don't get to celebrate when someone makes it? Like, what's the point of going through? And like, this is the shared struggle thing. Like, this is the thing that like doing all this as someone who played sports and like struggles with, you know, the parts of what success and failure look like outside of the world of sports. It's so much harder to define. What's it like when you don't have as much shared struggle with people in the ways that you've been used to, but like going through what you guys just described, like going through what Alex and Caroline have and what all the rest of us do, like that's the different relationship for me and some of the people I've gotten to know through work now, is starting to get to the point where, man, you get to see some people that, you know, were just like you, picking up whatever shifts they could, who have come through, you know, I mean, God, way longer and more arduous paths than I can ever, you know, identify with myself personally. But watching those people then go on to get the things they've been working for, like that's the drug. That's why we all do this. Like, that's the only thing that makes any of this worth it. And so, you know, with Dad, like there's the part of me being able to look now at the way he has reinvented himself on the other side of this, of like gushing with pride. Like I sit here, you know, and get kind of choked up again talking about that. But then there's, you know, the people that you meet in a different way that you grow those relationships with, like this, through just work as the bedrock, that you watch accomplish what they want. And like that was all really present in that scene in a way that struck a chord.
Like, this is a very Harry Lyles Jr. pro podcast, I'm assuming.
Oh, shit, yeah. See,
you know, seeing our guy going around the horn today, you know, and like, did he win? I was at the eye doctor. Oh, my
and,
God.
And he shouted out his mom on his birthday. FaceTime. It was great.
Oh, my gosh, stop. You know, and that's what I mean. Like, Mike, that was such a great way of saying that. Like, what's the point if we can't, like, seeing your people go do great things and being able to like turn on, well, I mean, I walk around places and I'll walk by and I'm like, oh, there's Mike on TV again. This is awesome. Hey, Mike, what's going on? What are you talking about? What are you doing? So it's just like so fun to see, or I see other friends that will like shout out something that Alex is doing, or like, yeah. And it's in that, I think, again, that's why that scene was so relatable, where it's like knowing that the people that you respect and love move on, but that doesn't mean that you're not ever, like, you're never leaving their corner. Like, you still, like, they're your people. Like, they're always going to be your people. I just loved it.
Yeah, I didn't want to not talk about that moment, because it was in a show of very heavy moments. That one was light and just made me feel really good. Mm-hmm. So as we cross into the hour 30 mark of a 45 minute TV show, Caroline, we've got thankfully a whole nother season of this coming at some point. Where, again, you were last to the Zoom, you've got to go first. Where are we going in season 3? What needs to be answered besides, you know, Phoebe and the boobs?
What a band name.
That's a great punk band name. Well, you know, where
Alex can play flute, jazz flute.
Where are we going? Is there any stuff that needs to be rectified that we haven't thought about, you know, obviously, you know, the Nate thing is looming large. Roy and Keeley looming large. Ted continuing to better himself, and then, you know, is he staying in London for long term? I think that's a big question when the series wraps, will get answered. Where else needs to be answered in season 3?
Oh man, I think I'm curious to see how big they go with regards to just the soccer itself, because like, what do we consider a success for Ted? What do we consider, you know? And there was this like, has any team been relegated and come back to win the championship type thing? And so like, my dorky ass self is like, go win the championship. Like, I will take it, beat Man United, beat everyone that I've ever heard of from Premier League. Like, let's do it.
Beat all the lads. Every single lad out there.
All the bruvs.
All the chaps.
All the bruvs are going down. Nice chaps. But I think, like, you know, the things that we talked about are the big, like, I'm most concerned about Roy and Keeley. Like, I want to see where that comes in. I'm very excited to see, you know, we didn't really talk about Sam's last scene, Sam's flash forward, buying, and that ties into what we've talked about with his journey, but buying the space to create a Nigerian restaurant. And I thought that I'm so excited to see his journey as someone who was not team Rebecca and Sam because of the just innate power struggle issues. I liked it in the sense that they're two beautiful people that should just be
beautiful.
They should just be on each other.
I didn't hate it. but from the standpoint of like, is this appropriate? So to that extent where I'm like, no, this really isn't appropriate. I still was a little kind of like, oh yeah, okay, you're right. That's not a good idea. But I don't know. I just think there's so many things that I never would have picked the way that this season went. So I don't even begin to give myself enough credit to think about where they could send the next season. I think they need to bring in a couple, maybe like a new player just to spice things up. They got to get, you know, a couple new faces in the locker room or something like that. Hopefully they don't lose anybody, but we know how that stuff goes.
Mike, what do you need to see in season three?
The only thing I am like relatively certain or like looking for is I think Roy leaves the club. Like, I think Roy very quickly cycled through all
you
of
just
the
heard
like
Caroline deep.
I know, but it's like
podcasting is not a visual medium, but that look in her face.
I didn't even mean to
we
make
gotta
the
release
noise
the
I
video
made.
On YouTube.
Yeah, just oh. Like.
Sorry. But like, honestly, that level of natural deflation was the same face motion Ted made when Nate mentioned his son in that scene. Like, that was some of the best facial acting in the episode, but I digress. So job well done, Caroline. Great face acting.
Thank you.
But I think Roy leaves the club and kind of figures out. I actually think he's got a career in something working with kids. I think we've gotten a lot of subtle hints along the way that Roy really like his relationship with Phoebe first and foremost, but I think he really vibes well with children. And I think there's going to be something related to that because they just cycled him through. Like, you know, Keeley helped him get into broadcasting at first and then he went into coaching. Like it's former player 101 of here are the things that are on the tray for you to do, go through them. And I think this whole thing has been about Roy kind of figuring out that like, you know what, maybe there is more to him than all these things. And I kind of want to see him get that because I think he's like a really round character that deserves that kind of like fulfillment. I think he's displayed all along the way that he's kind of ready for that.
Alex, queen of the theories, first of her name. Where are we going in season three?
First of all, I just hope that Roy reps Cheez-Its and 5-Hour Energy. Can I just go on record saying that? Maybe that's where it is. I really hope he just takes like the mic journey and just reps everything.
Oh my God,
you know. Oh. That's a compliment, by the way. I'm you know, putting you two in comparison. I, you know,
and any comparison to Roy Kent, that you do me far too much.
Exactly. So you know, I think some people have said, like, well, Ted doesn't have, I mean, he's got sassy, but clearly they're not investing anything in that relationship. Maybe they will next season. I don't know. Ted's got to go home. He's not, and I think they've painted this as like, he's not going to make London his home. He's still in the corporate apartment. He's not dating anybody. They've made multiple references this season to how like Christmas, you know, here's a guilt gift. He got the drone for his son. He's a family man. He loves his son. He cannot be a continent away from his son. The only reason he went away to begin with is because he thought it would save his marriage. He knows it won't. He knows the team is there and he loves it, but there's just no way a character like Ted could stay that far from his son. I just don't believe it. And so I think like at the conclusion of season three, I hope to God, like he gets a sweet college football job in the US and goes back home. And that's how it ends, you know? And that's not so much a theory as it is just, I would like that from my heart.
I mean, it's a show we were talking earlier. This is a show about fathers and sons. It's the number one theme, number one theme in this show.
Sorry. They don't use cats in the cradle like at some point. Like
I just hear Jason Kirk saying Fathers and Sons. Like, I can't shut down full cast Fathers and Sons. Never gonna. Fathers? Anyway.
So we've had, I mean, it's a generational thing. We have had Ted explore this relationship with his father, what happened there, him opening up to Doc, and then, yeah, the same thing. It's the thing that Nate says that's the most biting. It's the most hurtful. Mm-hmm. We see, you know, again, Ted puts his phone down. His son is his screensaver. They show us that on purpose. That's the next step for Ted is how does he grapple with this? Ted is not an absent father. That's not how he's going to live his life. He's made it his whole mission to, you know, to be this father figure to his players. But I mean, we got to see Ted be just an incredible father in season one. And I think that's where we go. Now they don't do anything without, you know, that's not intentional. When Richmond gets unrelegated or whatever it is,
promoted, unrelegated, yeah, it's catching on.
they say Richmond, a team without a major title or a major trophy or something. They're setting us up for, you know, the Bruvs to make a run, and I'm looking forward to that. I'm gonna holster my season three theories because I don't really have any right now. It's just it's all fresh. Trent Krim's writing a book or he's working on a Netflix doc or something. But this season was fucking what a banger! Like,
it was awesome.
Lived up to every expectation and beyond. I think that's the most incredible thing about it is the highest of expectations. And it hit them in spades. Like it was far better than I thought it would be. Just like if season one was far better than I thought it could be. It's just incredible the heights that this show has risen to. So I'm obviously very much looking forward to season three. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for
breaking
having me.
Down the finale. Of course, you're always welcome. Tell the folks, where's the content?
The content is at Bet for the Win, and you can find all sorts of Twitter things, a lot of exclamations about all sports. Ted Lasso.
You're terrible at this.
Bachelor's starting back up, Bachelorette. So at CW Darney on Twitter.
Links are going to be in the show notes, folks. Just find it there. Mike, where can the folks catch you? See what you're up to.
Canny and Golic Jr. is on ESPN Radio Monday through Friday from 3 to 7 Eastern. As you mentioned, I am fortunate to get to be teammates in a college football booth. It's usually on Saturdays on E2 with Anish Shroff and Taylor McGregor. And coming up here soon as the college football playoff rankings get going out, you can see me and Jason Fitz and Christine Williamson on Rankings Reaction on all the ESPN fun digital platforms.
And Alex, this wraps another season of Ted Lasso. We have been talking about this show every week for like over three months now. It really, we deserve a Mai Tai on the beach with Brett Goldstein. It has been,
I agree,
my utmost honor to do this with you week in and week out. You are the engine that makes this show run. Tell the folks, where is your content?
You're a liar. The content is everywhere. For the Win, ftw.usatoday.com. Or, you know, follow me on Twitter if you want some hot takes at Alex McDaniel. I got a lot of opinions about fried chicken, and that's pretty much what you'll get out of it. But no, Kyle, this has been a blast, and you're amazing. Thank you for asking me to do this, and I look forward to a next season. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I look forward to us talking about Hot Rod here in a couple of weeks, I'm sure.
Yes.
You're giving it. You're letting her do it. I love this. Good.
Hot Rod and Wimbledon, apparently, is what's on tap for
the
us.
The twofer. So. All right. Yeah,
We'll watch them in the Criterion Collection. Folks, if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to support the show, it's patreon.com/bigscreensports. We'll see you on Monday. Thanks for listening.